The fanciers of swords could never make up their minds which of the two was better. But certainly they were the unquestioned masters. So a group of samurai one day thought, we've got to put this to the test. We think that probably Mr. Matsushima is tops. But Mr. Yamaguchi comes so close. So they took a sword by each master and they went to a stream. And they first of all took Mr. Yamaguchi's sword. And they dipped it in the stream with the edge facing upstream. And they set a piece of paper floating downstream. And as it came to the sword simply, without being moved, the paper divided itself down the blade, joined together, and floated on. Well, you know, that's a hard act to follow. Anyway, they took Mr. Matsushima's sword and dipped that in the stream, and likewise set a piece of paper floating towards it. And what do you suppose happened? Just as the piece of paper approached the edge of the sword, it moved to one side, avoided it, and then went back into course and continued. And so obviously Mr. Matsushima was the better of the two swordsmiths. Why? Because the highest accomplishment in fencing is called the no sword school. To be so good at fencing that you never have to use a sword. And there are all kinds of marvelous tales about great samurai trained in Zen and swordsmanship who never, never had to use a sword. You may have seen a movie called Samurai, which comes in three parts, takes you three evenings to see it. And it's the life of Miyamoto Musashi, who was one of the greatest swordsmen in all Japanese history. It doesn't follow his life all the way through. It only comes to the point where he had a duel with another champion who insisted on challenging him out of vanity. And how Musashi takes him on, fighting him at first only with an oar that has had the blade chopped off. But he maneuvers him into a position on the beach where the rising sun dazzles his opponent. And when his opponent makes a terrific swipe at him, he jumps over the sword, draws his own sword, and kills him instantly. But after that, he is very unhappy that he had to kill such a swordsman. And finally, he takes the advice of the Zen master Takuan, who's all along been trying to dissuade him from a military career. So sometime later, he was on his way to Kyoto, and this meant that he had to cross Lake Biwa in a ferry boat, small ferry boat that was rowed. And when he was on board, another samurai, who was a very vulgar fellow who had had too much sake to drink, came aboard and saw Musashi. Ah, he said, what school of swordsmanship do you belong to? Musashi said, the no sword school. By this time the boat had started. No sword school. I'd like to see your no sword school. And this drunk drew his sword. And Musashi said, now wait a minute. Says, this is a crowded boat. And if we start a duel, people will get hurt, and they're just innocent bystanders. So let's go to that island over there, and we can fight it out. So he said to the ferryman, over to that island. And he changed the course of the boat and went to the island. And this drunken swordsman was so eager to get out and fight that he jumped onto the sand. And immediately Musashi took the ferryman's oar and pushed the boat back. left him there, and he said, "You see, my no sword school." So if I say to you, "Hi," you say, "Hi." If I say, "How are you?" you say, "Fine." There you are, see? There's your original self. But if I should say in the middle of a conversation, "You fine? Where have you been lately?" "Oh, I went to Mexico for a trip." "Where did you go?" "Oh, I went to Acapulco." "Did you enjoy yourself there?" "Not so bad." "Why is my hand like Buddha's hand?" "How do you handle that one?" And a master in such a situation said to, when his disciple blocked, he said to him, "So far your answers have been quite natural and easy. Why do you feel some obstruction when I ask you about my hand being like Buddha's hand?" Which in other words indicates, use your brains. And he won't, you see, because he's used to linear thinking. He's used to keeping on one track. Now this, you notice, you see, we're all on this. And therefore, when there's a conversation going on, we are uncomfortable if somebody changes the subject without ritual preparation. We are likewise uncomfortable when we're in the presence of crazy people who might change the subject altogether too abruptly. And same way with drunks who may not observe the amenities of etiquette in their conversation. We're all hung up on these tracks, which is to have a one-track mind. You can't jump. When the hands are clapped, the sound issues without hesitation. When flint is struck with steel, the spark comes out at once. But he goes on to explain that in such a situation, you must not be in a hurry, because that itself would be a block. And blocking, in this sense of the word, is exactly what the Buddhists mean by attachment. When they say, "Have no worldly attachment," it doesn't mean that you're to give up enjoying your dinner. It means giving up blocking, getting beyond the state where your flow is interrupted and so proceeds jerkily, as if the wheel were made too tight for the axle. So we would quite correctly translate attachment with the American slang equivalent hang-up. So it is the hang-up, therefore, the attempt to arrive at the solution to a problem demanding immediate action by reasoning, by calculation, which must take us along the linear path, whereas the event itself lies in a non-linear dimension. Never solve it that way. So also, with the curious property we call beauty, or for that matter, virtue in human behavior. We know very well when we are in the presence of forced virtue. So this happens. Once upon a time, the great tea master, Rikyu, went to the tea ceremony. And the host was very, very proud of a new tea caddy that he had bought, made of pottery. And Rikyu didn't notice it. At least so he thought. Which showed, because he was looking for it to be noticed, that he wasn't quite on to the philosophy of tea. I had a friend, Japanese artist, who one day did a calligraphy for me. He took an ordinary small Western house painter's brush, about an inch wide, and he did the Chinese characters for 1, 2, 3. That's one stroke. These are all horizontal strokes, 2 strokes, 3 strokes. And there was something just fantastic about this. The brush, you see, was partly sometimes dry, so that you've got hair lines instead of solid black. It so happened that a few days later we were due to receive a visit from Dr. Suzuki, the great Zen scholar. And I said, I'm going to hang that picture in my office. And the artist said, I hope he won't notice it. Which is because a fine work of art must so fit its surroundings as not to stand out like a sore thumb. So in this way, Rikyu didn't notice the tea caddy. But this so bothered the owner that after the ceremony was over, he smashed it. However, one of his students knew that it was very valuable, and he collected all the pieces. And then he had them restored by putting molten gold as a cement. This is an old technique. And so when it is finished, you see the original piece with all these spidery lines of gold across it. Sometime later, a son of the host brought out this mended tea caddy when Rikyu was having tea. And he said, you know, that is most remarkable. When I saw that before, it was good, but now it's perfect. So this is what one would call a controlled accident. And all great art is a controlled accident. That is to say, it has in it the component of control, but it also has the component of the accident and of the natural. And it's getting those two together that is the marvelous thing. It's the same in human relationships. Let's take the relationship of love. If I am in love with a woman whom I can control, she may be have a flawless body, beautiful behavior, but if I control her completely, I might as well have a plastic doll. Only if she has a little mole on her cheek, or something like that, or some kind of unpredictability of character, then I know she's human, because the accidental has been introduced into the domain of the orderly. So likewise, when you go into a person's house and everything is spotless, everything in its place, you feel, my God, if you smoke a cigarette, you'll make the ashtray dirty. No, it's just that terrible. It has not got a quality which in Arabic is called baraka. Now, baraka means grace, roughly. But baraka is a quality when you say of someone, he fits like an old shoe. or you've got a favorite saucepan that's old and dirty, but it's marvelous, or an old pipe that you smoked, see, where it's become very suited to you. It has baraka, grace. So the puzzle for every artist is how to get grace to strike. How to let an accident happen. Well, once upon a time there was a sculpture contest at the University of Chicago, no, it was at the Chicago Art Institute. And the competition was that every entrant was given a cubic foot of plaster of Paris. Do something with it. Now, the competition was won by a woman, and she started out by looking at that piece of plaster of Paris and said, "This thing is so perfect that it doesn't know what it wants to be." And so she grabbed it in both hands and flung it on the floor. Then pieces were chipped off and it was cracked and so on. And then she looked at it again. And she said, "Now I know what it wants to do." And so by following the grain which she had introduced into that, she made something beautiful. Now, following the grain is what you do when you do a Rorschach test. You see this blodgy thing, which is the Tao, which is the primordial wiggly universe. And then you see something in it. You see an image in it. And you see a far more beautiful image than you can ever draw by what we call eidetic vision. And you assist the piece of wood or stone or whatever it is in which you see that image to do its thing. Now experiment with yourselves in this. Look when you, especially when you wake up first thing in the morning, look at patterns in drapery. Look at shadows on the wall. And go into that state where you are receptive to seeing images. And you will begin to see all kinds of faces and trees and landscapes. Leonardo da Vinci did this. He used to go out and look at a wall which was weathered, made of bricks, covered with bird shit and all kinds of scratches and so on. And he would watch it until he saw a vast scene. He described seeing a whole battle going on. There was a Chinese Zen monk who had long hair, very unusual, and he used to drink an enormous amount of wine. And then when he was really far out, he'd dip his hair in ink and then slosh it over a piece of paper. Then he'd dry it out, and in the morning he'd come back and look at what happened. And he put himself into this state of mind, and he'd begin to see a landscape. And it's fantastic when you put yourself to this, how detail after detail fits in. And all he had to do was make little touches of the brush to bring it out for everyone to see. And it looks, when we go to the caves of Lascaux and those ancient parts of France and go down and see the prehistoric paintings of animals, that it looks very much like they had followed natural formations in the stone on the wall of the cave, which had evoked their imagery of cattle that are to us inconceivably realistic for people that primitive. But we shall always find that when the artist has been following eidetic imagery and has not been trying to construct the image by himself. Because this whole world is created in that way. We're not aware of this. because we are so accustomed to seeing it in the way that we think is real and normal. You can also train yourself to see things which haven't been seen before. This is what many artists do. For example, in the history of Western art, 700 years ago, there were no landscape painters. Everyone was a portrait painter. Or they painted scenes of the doings of human beings, angels and gods and so forth. And whenever there was landscape, it was merely incidental background. Now, in the course of time, people got fascinated with the landscape part. And they withdrew the figures and left the background. And so we got landscape painting. And the first people who saw landscape painting looked at it and said, that's not what I call a picture. Why? Because they had seen landscape hitherto as insignificant background. And it took painters to draw people's attention to the beauty of landscape. Now, do you see what we could do, and we are only just beginning to think about, is soundscape. When we record something, or go to a concert, we have the impression that there is the thing there. And so, in radio studios, they cover the walls with soundproof tile to keep out the sound of traffic. So that you have the thing. The important thing you're supposed to notice is the speech. But the odd thing is, you listen to that back in your home with the windows open. All street noises are coming in. There's no reason why they shouldn't have been there in the first place. Well, now let's move to that. Think of soundscape. The hum that's going on behind all the things we're supposed to be doing. And you can realize it's very beautiful. Just as you can see that a landscape is. The humscape, you see? And so there is become a school of musical composers, like John Cage, who treat us to background noise, or to silent concerts, in which the concert is the sound spontaneously occurring in the auditorium. Now you may say that's not music. Who knows? Well, so, the world then is a humscape, is a landscape, a skyscape. And over thousands of years, important people, that means strong people, decided what was important to notice. And they told their children that that was important. We still do this because when a child is messing around and we find the child is scrubbling around and making patterns in mud, we feel that the child is doing something unimportant and say, stop that. Now learn to use a pencil. A child points at something and says, what's that? And Alice says, well, that's a table. No, that. I say, it's wood. The child says, yeah, because he knows it's all wood. But I mean, that. Oh, don't be silly. That doesn't matter. So in this way, we learn the official interpretation of the cosmic Rorschach plot, which is based on, as I pointed out, certain criteria as that you must survive. It's your duty to live, see? Which is a double bind, because it says again, you are commanded to do the spontaneous. It's your duty to be spontaneous, because all life is spontaneous. So everybody is in a bind about this. But there it is, the world that we see is a creation of eidetic imagery. So wherever we select the human areas as being significant areas, and so they're called human, where the Rorschach blot is wiggling in the way that we call human wiggling, where it wiggles very much, and the worst maximal points of wiggling in our environment are other people. I mean, there are other things that wiggle. Cats wiggle, but not quite so interestingly. The wind in the trees wiggles, but again, it's more predictable. But the human wiggle is the least predictable wiggle in the total Rorschach blot around us. So we call that human. So you see that it is in that way that you have performed Maya, the world illusion. But Maya also means art and also means magic. And so the magical evocation of the world of things from the formless world, which means from the world of pure wiggle, is the creation.